Joe, how you doing?
Just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Well, tonight I think we decided to discuss the assassination of Martin Luther King. Who was Martin Luther King? What was his legacy? What was his role in setting up modern America? I guess you could say Martin Luther King Jr. Of course, was a civil rights leader. Was shot. Reportedly at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4th, 1968. He was rushed to St. Joseph's Hospital and was pronounced dead. He was the prominent leader of the Civil Rights Movement, Nobel Prize laureate, known for nonviolence and civil disobedience. Of course, his alleged assassin, of course, according to the official narrative, his assassin, convicted assassin, was James Earl Ray, a fugitive from the Missouri State Penitentiary. He was able to break out on his own, reportedly snuck out in a bread truck. He was arrested in June 8, 1968, in London, of all places, at Heathrow Airport, and extradited back to the United States. He was trying to get, I think, to North Africa and charged with the crime. He, I believe, as the story goes, he pled guilty on following the instructions of his defense attorney, Percy Forman. He subsequently tried to get a retrial, recanted that plea, and was never given a new trial. I believe in 1998 or 99 there was a mock trial, which found that he was indeed innocent, and there was a conspiracy, a government conspiracy to kill Dr. King. And I believe there was a civil trial came to the same conclusion of a wide government conspiracy. Interestingly enough, in the 1970s, I believe, the House Subcommittee on Assassinations came to the conclusion that along with the assassination of JFK, Martin Luther King's assassination was also a conspiracy, meaning more than one person, if I have that right. But there was no official investigation after that, neither the JFK assassination or Martin Luther King's murder. So that's kind of the official narrative. Martin Luther King, sort of a secular saint, a prophet of the modern era. Of course, he's been given only American to have a specific holiday in his name. He is probably as popular as Mother Teresa in the public, at least his public perception. He stood for peace and integration. Coming together of all the races and doing away with racial hatred and these things. An advocate for equality, and so that's kind of what the public idea, or at least the popular vision of Martin Luther King is. What's your take on the late Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, he's a complicated individual. He is a created fictional character. The individual that the media presents to us and his life and his background are fiction. They're for the purpose of creating a religious figure. We have talked many times about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, how they were deliberate cultural inputs from a malevolent society that we have been identifying, over the last few months. And then beyond that, then they inserted feminism. But before those elements, the one that they actually first inserted in the culture to start the process of its destruction was integration. And just to back up, integration was basically an an idea that is so preposterous that the only way they could really present it to America in the 50s was as a religion. In other words, they had to basically create King as the cult figure of the new religion, as a kind of metaphysical saintly person, and they had to equate integration with religion, Christianity, Christian principles, Judaism, because that was the only way they could bamboozle the public into not recognizing it for what it was, which was just a way to make individuals in society easier to enslave. And I'll just, you know, digress for 1 second and point out that if anyone wanted to, you know, help African Americans in the middle 1950s, the last thing in the world you would attempt to do would be to integrate that ethnicity into European ethnicities. They were very different. And moreover, the African ethnicity in America had been making basically straight up progress since the end of the Civil War. All of the misery index statistics were improving. And I think that may have been why they rushed integration into existence, is because they didn't want kind of African-American culture to get to a threshold where it was basically able to defend itself, you know, because it had become strong enough, that it could do so. It's strong enough economically, strong enough in terms of its education. And so you had Martin Luther King come into existence. And I would first of all say, you know, a lot of the information that I have used in my research, I got from Miles Mathis. He did a really good paper on Martin Luther. I come to a lot of different conclusions, and I have a lot more sort of my own takes on different things, but I would suggest everyone go there and read it, because, you know, Miles is a really good researcher, lots of very original insights in his paper. But, to kind of understand the fictional religious personality that was brought to the media as Martin Luther King Jr., you got to go all the way back to his father, because his father's name was not Martin Luther. Martin Luther King Jr. that's the first step of the fiction. The story, he changed his name. Martin Luther King Jr.'s father changed his name to Martin Luther from Michael, which was the name given to Martin Luther King, was Michael. That's his real legal name. Neither father nor Michael the Jr. ever bothered to legally change their name. We know them as Martin Luther just because that's how they are represented in the media, but that's not their legal names. Now, why did he do this? Why did Martin Luther King Jr.'s father decide to change his name? Well, this, Tim, is where you can start to see the malevolence becomes visible. It's because, like I've said, you know, many times it's sort of like it's where they come up with the stories of how they maneuver certain things, you know, the circumstantial evidence of their lives, their storyline, that are really implausible. This is kind of one of the things that the citizen has to be always alert for. And I'll just give an example. It's like Stuart Brand's story about, you know, how he ended up with meeting Ken Kesey and getting on the bus, you know, becoming married pranksters. He said, well, I had taken pictures of American Indians, and Ken's book, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, had an Indian in it. This was the explanation as to how they decided to get together and become the married pranksters. So it's completely ridiculous. And a little more plausible is the fact that Brand was stationed at Fort Dix when it was an MKUltra center, and Kesey was an employee of MKUltra in Palo Alto. That seems to be a little bit more direct connection between the two. But, you know, so you get to see that the circumstantial evidence of the implausible storyline is very powerful. And in the case of King, his father, he said, well, I went to Germany at a Baptist conference in 1935, and I came back and I was so inspired, I changed my name to Martin Luther. Now, this is just completely insane. It's ridiculous. First of all, the Baptist religion doesn't like Martin Luther, right? Mm-hmm. And secondly, the idea that King even attended the conference is just head-scratchingly implausible, because the church that he was a preacher at was completely impoverished, right? They were trying to do bake sales to keep it in existence. The idea they would put, you know, their preacher on a junket to attend the Baptist conference in Germany is just crazy. Then another point, they have pictures of the conference. There's actually, go online, you can see there's very clear pictures of all of the attendees. It's 100% white.
Yeah, this is the day you couldn't jump on a plane. This would have been
you had to get visas and stuff, and there's no black people, and they have pictures. Just go and look. Just tell the audience, and go and Google Baptist Conference 1935. And then finally, the idea that he would have been inspired is really funny, because this was at the time when the Baptists were basically more or less cozying up to Adolf Hitler. The conference had huge swastikas on the platform. Hitler addressed the conference, sent him a telegram, and the conference is considered by the Baptists to be a moment of great shame, because they say, you know, that was the moment when the Baptist, you know, organization, we cozied up to racism. So now from there, this guy comes back and he's supposed to be inspired, King's father, and he says, I'm going to change my name to Martin Luther. See, it just makes no sense whatsoever. Now, why they did it? Well, it's because it identifies their character, Martin Luther, as a religious leader. It's really that simple. What they're doing is they're creating a religion. It's going to be the cult of integration. They know that integration is basically irrational at best, but they will, you know, get rid of that problem by having it presented to the public as part of a religion. So they need a religious figure, and this is where they get King from. Now, King's father, where they get him is, King's father is a Prince Hall Freemason. And if you look at the black celebrities at this time, you can see that Prince Hall was basically the conduit into America, you know, media. I mean, basically everyone who is, you know, black, who is inside the, you know, the media world is a Prince Hall Mason, you know, Thurgood Marshall, Alex Haley. Mm-hmm. It could just go on and on. These guys are all, W.E.D. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington. These are Prince Hall Masons, Dizzy Gillespie. You can't find anybody. Paul Robinson, Duke Ellington. In other words, the reason that they become celebrities is they're able to come through the portal of the Masonic control.
Louis Armstrong?
I don't know about him. Okay. Actually, he might not be. In general, Nat King Cole, W.C. Mm-hmm. Handy, you know, Dizzy Gillespie. I mean, these guys are all Prince Hall Masons. So just as a collection of Paul Robinson was a Mason. Okay, so mm-hmm. So what you have is a very small group of basically celebrities. And a high fraction of them are coming through, Masonic control. This is why these guys become celebrities, in my opinion, is that they are under control so that they can basically maneuver them if they need them to do certain things culturally.
By the way, just Google it real fast. Louis Armstrong, according to Google, was a proud member of a Masonic fraternity. So,
well, I mean, there it is. It's 100%.
According to Google. So
there you go. Okay, well, there it is. But, you know, the thing is that, wow, what a shock. But so the thing is, so that's why it would have been really out of pattern if King hadn't come from a Masonic family.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been out of pattern. So he comes from a Masonic family. His grandfather and his father were both Prince Hall Masons. King was not, at least as far as anyone knows. There's no documentation of it. Though there is this weird, after his death, the Prince Hall organization came up and they said they wanted to make Martin Luther King Jr. a Mason on site, right? Which is like a kind of this weird, never before performed idea where they were just going to make him a Mason after he was dead. So according to anyway, so they, this is how they get them. They control them in this way. And now,
Would it be free to say like Prince Saul Masonry is Black Freemasonry, like Jewish B'nai B'rith is Jewish Freemasonry?
Well, it's Black Freemasonry.
Okay.
And but it would be under control, in my opinion, of the larger organization. So in other words, when they as I would see it, when they take their oaths, right, when they go up their levels, basically what they end up with is these oaths making them obligated to these other levels, which are the ones that are, you know, controlled by Scottish Rite Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. So that's how, and that's why you get these, you know, the relationship even today in Black rap music and other, you know, entertainment, African-American artists, there's always been this suggestion that they're all coming out of Masonry, mm-hmm. you know, and they make Masonic hand signs and whatnot. So this was going on with King. And so now King, you know, becomes, he's presented to the public as a PhD from Boston University in Divinity, Boston University's Divinity School, very high level Divinity School. And when you look at this story, it just, again, it makes no sense. King is like 25. He has both a master's and a bachelor. You know, again, it just, the timeline makes no real sense. But he's given a PhD. He's a doctor. But after the fact, it comes out that he had plagiarized, mm-hmm. You know, his work. And it's just amazing that you get quotes from like Boston University, which was actually, you know, someone pointed out that, wait a second, the PhD thesis that King put together is a fraud. And they actually were, again, they were like Gloria Steinem, you know, when she was caught, you know, they didn't know what to do. So they issued this statement, which I think is pretty funny. They said, there is no question but that Dr. King plagiarized in his dissertation. Even so, no thought should be given to the revocation of Dr. King's doctorate degree, because such action would serve no purpose. And that was New York Times, October 11th, 1991, page 15. So you can see that, you know, right off the bat, you have a problem in that King is, you know, looking like he's fake. He's coming from a controlled Masonic, you know, organization. His name is for some reason been changed, and his PhD credentials are fake. And what Mathis says about it, which is what I agree with, is that the reason for the plagiarism is that the dissertation is actually just being created by the organization in back of King, and that's why they didn't really, you know, bother to actually come up with original scholarship. They just kind of cut and paste one together, and so then when someone went through it, they found that, wait a second, it's all fake. But one interesting side note is that there were a number of organizations that basically suppress knowledge of King's plagiarism. It was out for a number of years. And one of the individuals who worked to suppress it was Lynn Cheney, wife of Dick Cheney. She was actually the chairwoman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and it actually had a review which said, hey, this is a plagiarized PhD. But she, you know, basically just was able to keep this from the public. But this, you know, it also shows that the malevolence on both sides, that when we see the Republicans and the Democrats, that the fact is, you know, this is just a joke. I mean, they control both sides. And so even though Lynn Cheney should, in fact, have been working to expose King if she was this conservative Republican. But, you know, anyway, she didn't. So that brings King, he gets his PhD, and he gets hired in Montgomery, where he meets Rosa Parks. And this is where King becomes a famous person. It's Rosa Parks won't, be moved to the back of the bus. And, So she's arrested, and there's a protest, and Martin Luther King, who just showed up in town, has a meteoric rise to the head of all of these organizations inside of Montgomery, even though there were people who had been there longer and were very well qualified. For some reason, he had this meteoric rise, which was paralleled by his meteoric rise in the media.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, every newspaper and TV has got stories with this Martin Luther King guy, very similar to Gloria Steinem.
Mm-hmm.
When Steinem comes along, there was a longstanding, you know, feminist movement, mostly aligned with economic issues. She wants to basically wreck marriage and culture. And so, for some reason, she gets, you know, all of the publicity. A group, the Red Stockings, complained. They investigated her, and then they exposed her as a CIA agent. The same thing is happening with Martin Luther King. He is out of nowhere. He's becoming the leader of this organization. And in fact, the whole thing with Rosa Parks is fake. You know, they're constructing miraculous events, basically, in the new integration religion.
So just more street theater.
Yeah. I mean, well, like Rosa Parks. Well, first of all, in March of 1955, there was a 15-year-old black schoolgirl who named Claudette Colvin, I believe, and she wouldn't give up her bus seat, and there was a huge kerfuffle. But King hadn't got into place then, so nothing happens. They decide not to do anything, and also because this Colvin 15-year-old is a smart aleck. She's got a, you know, she's a sassy kind of attitude ridden, you know, kind of street person, or not street person, but she's tough. And, mm-hmm. and she, and anyway, so they decide that, well, nothing happens here. But with Rosa Parks, now Rosa Parks is given to the public as a seamstress, but in fact, she is working for the NAACP. And she's attending a Highlander folk school, which is funded by FDR and the Roosevelts as kind of a social activist school. But the most important thing is that she's also living with a Rhodes Scholar. She's actually, as far as being a seamstress, she's working with this guy, I believe his name is Clifford Durr. And he is a Rhodes Scholar, which, of course, is, you know, shows you, you know, the, where the control's coming from. But she has a full-time job at the NAACP. The picture of her, the real famous picture of her in the sitting in the front of the bus, and there's a white guy in back of her who looks, you know, troubled. That's staged. That guy is a reporter. they recreated that. That's all fiction. But the thing about Rosa Parks and why they chose her is, well, first of all, she's controllable. I mean, she is an NAACP. We'll get into that in a second, because this is, you'll get to see where all the malevolence is coming from. But Rosa Parks is very, very fair-skinned, you know, very Caucasian-looking. Her hair actually is kind of, you know, brushed in back in a bun. And she's the sweetest little thing. You know, she's wearing glasses. She's very fair-skinned. She has this very soft, gentle voice, just exactly the opposite of the Claudette Colvin with the mouth. So they've got themselves, you know, basically a you know, a theater where for the religious event, you know, where mm-hmm. they've got and you see in the religion of integration, the high sacrament is guilt. You know, Anton, I always stumble his last name, but Clivet, I believe, is how it's pronounced. He's a Jewish scholar. He worked for LaRouche. He studied the authoritarian personality, and he traced it, incidentally, interestingly enough, right to the home that Montague Norman lived. He said that some of the psychologists actually met there, so you get right into the whole Hitlerian, mm-hmm. you know, kind of creation structure. But Anton said, this is just being done because they want to create guilt, right? So in other words, he was referring to the Holocaust. You can see that was how they were going to function with the Holocaust, is that it would be a religion and guilt would be the high sacrament. But integration was also being treated in exactly the same way. And King basically is, his death becomes, you know, the representation of the Holocaust, basically. Just, he's just an individual. And so, so King takes over, and because I don't want to, you know, be too long-winded, I'm sure we can get into some of these details later, but he becomes basically the high priest. You know, he is Martin Luther. He is always photographed with religious people around him. And then he then presents his the basic platform of religion, which is integration. Now, you've got to understand how amazing this is, because he gives a speech, or a whole series of speeches, where he talks about, you know, white and black people hand in hand,
yeah.
Right? He talks about integration. He's not talking about economic development, academic development, social problems inside the black ethnicity. He's subtly changing the tone to but in the context of religion and guilt, to this idea of integration. And this, of course, and I'll refer to the great tome by Michael Jones, The Slaughter of the City. Man, I don't think you have any chance at all of understanding Martin Luther King if you haven't gone through that book, because there you get to see the malevolence and the deliberate government, well, basically secret society organization and plot to break up ethnicity among Europeans in the United States.
Yeah, this was the chapter... Martin Luther King and the Blackstone Rangers, about what happened in Chicago in 1966.
Right. But of course, it's also, you see, my point is that this is all in conjunction. You know, in other words, you've got the breaking up of the ethnic, the creating of the white middle class, the breaking up of their ethnic structures at the same time that the religion of integration is being developed.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're working hand in hand. It's, on one hand, you're breaking up the ethnic enclaves in the cities, but on the other hand, you're also creating a whole structure of guilt and and a religious context for this idea about integration.
Yeah. So you won't be able to articulate, much less even have a consciousness of your ethnicity of a community.
Sure.
And if you try to voice that, you'll come off as a, you know, as some sort of a backward Southern racist.
Well, but see, this is the point, is that they know in 1955 that if they try to insert integration on rational grounds, that people will just laugh at. The only way they can bring it in is with guilt and mysticism.
Yeah, and also there's strength in community and cohesion, and of course, integration is a code, or what's really seeking is social atomization.
Yeah, that's right. They're actually breaking... They're breaking us down into individuals, but they're also destroying ethnicity. It's a key thing. And so they bring in, the cult of integration, and it's all, King is their spokesperson. Right. And he has his speeches where he talks about, hand in hand, there's going to be, a black girl and, this is like such an important thing. There's a whole bunch of stuff to this, but I just wanted to skip to the end so we can, go back, and I'm sure you got, a lot of things you want to talk about. But okay, so the death of King, well, it's completely fictional. First of all, the day before, he goes to what's called the Mason Temple. Now, a lot of people say, well, it's not a Masonic temple. It's just a building that's named the Mason Temple. But you see, to the people who are organizing it, that's irrelevant. They are making their point.
Yeah.
And then now, secondly, so King says that, he says he's going to die. He foreshadows his death, which will be the next day. And he goes, I've been to the mountaintop. I want to live. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And if he allows me to go to the mountain, and I've looked over and I've seen the promised land.
Okay, so it's Moses now, yeah.
Exactly. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight, Now we as a people will get to the promised land. Now, the thing is, I mean, it's just completely preposterous, but he's obviously foreseeing his death, because what he's referring to is Deuteronomy 34, I think, you know, 4, something like that. So Deuteronomy, beginning of Deuteronomy, where Moses goes up and, you know, Jesus shows him the promised land. And then he says, hey, you're not going to make it, Moses, right? But so that's what Moses is doing. I mean, that's what a king is doing. He's like typology. He's literally saying that he is Moses. Once again, you know, it's Martin Luther, but he's in the Mason Temple and he's making a speech, and the very next day he's going to get killed. And notice that he could easily have created the typology using Christ. I mean, he's supposed to be a Christian. You know, Jesus had lots of moments when he knew he was going to die, and like he talks very much about, you know, like the kingdom of God and stuff. But he, you know, like the Mason Temple, you know, that would be more like Hiram Abiff and the Temple of Solomon and the Old Testament and Jewish perspective, wouldn't it? So Moses, Martin Luther King, decides to use a typology that's linking to the Old Testament, right? Now, April the 4th, he gets shot. And, you know, it's... I think it's obviously fake. I think what they've done is they've gotten about as much out of King as they can. And now his death will basically be the, you know, the most powerful thing they can do to promote the religion of integration. So that's how he was able to foresee his death. That's why, you know, the Jewish perspective of the promised land. And then King is supposedly shot, but, the photographs of King in the coffin, and this was something that Miles Mathis pointed out, it makes no sense. He's supposed to be shot in the right cheek, and his face is there. You can see it, and there's no bullet wound. So where's the bullet wound? It's supposed to be a .30-06. I fired this. It would leave a hole the size of the head. I mean, you'd have like an 8-inch hole. But this is a .30-06, dude. This would just blow his head off. So
you're saying the casket should have been closed.
The casket should have been closed. Someone who killed a headshot with .30-06, it would just be splatter city. So it's just preposterous.
Now, people are listening to this. They're saying that King did not die on April 4th, 1968. Where did he go?
You got me. maybe he went to, you know, Studio 54. I don't know. And I don't know for sure that he wasn't killed. I mean, they were in charge of his speeches. They could easily have got him to say such a thing.
Yeah.
And then shot him. I mean, because believe me, these guys play rough, and it's quite possible. I think that given the clarity of the foreshadowing, that it's hard to imagine that King would have, you know, accepted being shot.
Yeah.
And the fact that his face is unblemished in the casket suggests, I mean, you know, that he was just photographed and then off they take him.
Yeah.
You know, and then if you look from there, if you go into the story of James Earl Ray, you can see that it's just ridiculous.
Well, I mean, really, if you're thinking about it, is again, a lot of the, I guess, the incredulity that people might be feeling when they think that his death was faked. What we're saying is the narrative of him getting shot outside room 306, I think it was, at the Lorraine Hotel, could have been staged, and then the person who was Michael Luther King, playing Martin Luther King, could have been disposed of in a way that would enable him to have an open casket.
Well, exactly. And
right?
The thing is, just remember that.
Because you'd have to see him. I mean, obviously the effect would be seeing the pristine, resurrected, almost King in the casket. I mean, not because you, like you said, that half his face would have been blown off.
His face would have gone. But the thing is that, you know, you have, to me, the way I look at it is, you know, which one is the truly implausible? Was he able to actually see his death, right? Or was this fact staged? I mean, I would think that, you know, you can't see into the future.
Well, it's like a movie script, right? I mean,
right, exactly. Yeah. And so I would just say, you know, I mean, if I had to bet, I would go, you know, 90-10 that they just literally faked the whole thing. And then I would also say that if you look at James Earl Ray, I mean, obviously this is, you know, another just preposterous individual. Ray was supposed to have been a pornographer.
Mm-hmm.
before he became a white supremacist. Now, I first of all, let me just, you know, I know that now in our era, you know, people don't scratch their head, but in 1955, there weren't many pornographers, and I would say among white supremacists who tend to be Christian, there was like zero.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Right. You don't have pornographers, so why would they create this as a story? Well, because they're basically, you know, they're just making him as evil as they possibly can, and but the key is he's a white supremacist. So now you've got the double guilt of the Holocaust. You know, this was Gentiles being bad. And now poor Martin Luther King, our new Moses, is killed by a white supremacist. So now when, you know, you go forward and you've got, you know, Brown v. Board of Education and the Civil Rights Act, we've got all of these laws coming forward, right? You have this intimidation that the media, which has glommed on completely to King as a religious figure, right? They now have a way to basically short circuit the arguments against integration that come out of reason.
Yeah.
Because now you're literally saying, well, you know, we have a Moses and he's dead. The white supremacist killed him. You know, you're as evil as the white supremacist. Your argument is therefore false. You know, and that's really what happened. And so now you've got, ethnicity, which had been a value and had kept had produced so much wealth and strength for the individuals, you know, who were inside it, was now able to be attacked because it was being done so by the new religion, which had Martin Luther King. Now King, you know, one last thing, I'll shut up. So King was false in you know, so many ways. One of the, you know, the real clear ways you can see that this whole religious persona is just fake is that King was a huge whoremonger. I mean, this was documented by the FBI, which people have said, well, you know, maybe the FBI was biased. But moreover, it was well documented by Ralph Abernathy.
Yeah.
The black guy. And he said that on the, you know, that King, he actually documented King beating a prostitute. And he just said that this was constant. So what you have is a whoremonger pretending to be a religious figure, right? And pretending to be, you know, presenting integration as something that's going to be valuable for African Americans, right? If this is all just under the Masonic control, and this is why when King gives a speech, they get him to this place called the Mason Temple. And then he says, I can see my death. And he gives the Old Testament. You know, I can remember, this is also when Israel is actually, you know, coming into existence. And so King, you can see how effective and how economical all of this is, because, you know, they use the promised land with the idea that, you know, this is Israelite territory. There's no Palestinian.
What would you make of his apparent turn against the Vietnam War in 1967?
Oh, I think that I think, you know, I mean, I just think that they create plausible believability. You know, I mean, it's like Gloria Steinem, was she ever really caring about, you know, women? And you can give examples of where she's, you know, had sob stories and stuff.
Yeah.
I think so that with King to be a religious character, they have to distinct him, you know, from just, you know, just classical Americana, and so they try, and also they remember who their target audience is. They know they can't get the old people they're too smart. They're creating King as a religious figure for the sex, drug, and rock and roll boomer.
Yeah, I mean this is coinciding with the sexual revolution.
Yeah, exactly.
Integration, exactly. Long sex.
Well, like, and also they know that the Vietnam War is going to be something that they can use to get the sex, drugs, and rock and roll culture really animated.
Yeah, with Vietnam.
And so to have King is basically anticipating the, you know, the demographic kind of propensities of his target audience.
Yeah, in the opposition to the war was part of the alchemy.
That
the war was partly waged for is the opposition to the war. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the thing is that, again, you get into explanatory power. You have all these different positions of kings and weird things, you know, like where did his name come from? But once you understand that this is basically a very precisely designed assault on culture, where they're creating the context of religion in order to short circuit, you know, the kind of thinking about what they're actually doing in a rational way, in an evidence-based way, then everything makes sense. King makes perfect sense at that point.
It's also with the same thing they did with music, first with jazz music, you know, a few decades before in the 20s, but in the 50s with rock and roll was an attempt to popularize, you know, rhythm and blues and jazz music, particularly for the Mississippi Delta. You know, they brought, you know, there's Chess Records and Muddy Waters, and because this is largely a Jewish operation, to promote this type of music for the purposes of promoting ultimately social, you know, racial integration.
Cult of integration. I mean, that's why the Rolling Stones and the Beatles are basically rhythm and blues, right? The Rolling Stones more so, but the Beatles were bringing, you know, African music basically to the white young, the baby boomers, and this was going to be hand in hand with the religion of integration. It was all just one system, you know.
And the thing was, through music, you could break down these taboos, or this notion of, you know, a taboo is a reflection of ethnic consciousness. And so if you just take the taboo and it's isolated, it comes across as being racist or being closed-minded. But if you take in the context of ethnic consciousness and an ethnic community wanting to preserve itself and promote itself and perpetuate itself, well, ultimately that does mean that at some level there's going to be exclusion, and there's going to be people who only want to procreate with people of the same ethnicity in these things. And the important point is that these communities, such as they exist, have a right to exist and perpetuate themselves so long as they're not violating other people's, you know, rights or breaking the laws. But the point here at some, and what's been proven by people like E. Michael Jones, is that there was high-level malevolence and social engineering, psychological warfare going on, the manipulation of the court system, the abuse of the law, and these things break apart these communities, a misinterpretation of the laws and these things to malevolently break apart these communities, to destroy the ethnic consciousness, get them out of these neighborhoods, to get them in the suburbia and deracinate them so they can be manipulated. And so, again, it is high-level manipulation that has to be high-level malevolence that has to be recognized here. Because the problem, if you take it in its isolation, it sounds kind of trivial. You know, are you really worried that a white girl is going to dance with a black guy? And that sounds kind of close-minded and bigoted. But from the standpoint of ethnic consciousness and also preserving certain values, because inevitably this is a problem that's never been fully addressed, at least in the mainstream press, given the narrative of the civil rights movement, is the problem of some of the sexual values and mores being promoted by integration, also through music. These were very problematic. Of course, they've been very problematic in the black community, you know, considering now they have a 75-80% illegitimacy rate.
Well, they've completely destroyed it.
Yeah, this creates social chaos. So the proof is in the pudding. Someone has to answer for this. I mean, people, when you're promoting rock and roll, Alan Freed promoting rock and roll and these things, the entertainment, the music, these things, to promote this social meltdown, you got to see the bigger picture. And some people, so it's very difficult to see the bigger picture because it's not being explained to them in the mainstream press, the history books. They're given this fairy tale, you know, black versus white. You know, what I mean, black versus, I mean, is a good versus evil, a simple narrative of events. And there's something.
Well, they're given religion.
Yeah.
I mean, they're given Martin Luther King birthday. I mean, he's the only individual in American history that has his own, you know, day of, you know, national holiday. They're given religion. They're still, even today, if people question, it's a religious response.
Yeah. You know? And I mean, if you look at the illegitimacy rate now in the general white population, is higher than it was in the black population in the early 1960s, when it was considered a crisis by. That senator, what's his name? You know, the Irish senator. Patrick Moynihan.
Moynihan.
He's the one that came with an idea of reversing that by consciously giving like a gainful employment to young black men so they could form families, but he was rejected. And a lot of the stuff that Dr. King called social, I remember his speech against the Vietnam War, And the speech itself, it's hard to assail on its own. He's saying America's the biggest purveyor of violence in the world today. Stop its war. And America spends far more on bombs and bullets to napalm babies, women and children in some far off country than it does spending on programs of social uplift. There's a problem. Well, you know, with the nascent priorities. But what were these problems of social uplift? Well, I mean, what were these programs of social uplift? Was it giving $1 million to the Blackstone Rangers, this gang, to chase out, ethnic Poles in Chicago so you could, chase them into the suburbs? You know, this is all done under the guise of integration and social uplift. So you have to look at, there's the rhetoric, but then there's the reality. Right?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
There's well reality. Said. You know, and these are proxy forces. The same way that U.S. government goes in and supports Islamic radicals in Syria, or Libya to disrupt it, to achieve some sort of geopolitical objective. But this isn't explained to people. So when you're criticizing integration, and people only understand the storybook narrative that they've been given, the fairy tale narrative of the mainstream press, what are you saying? What are you, a racist?
Yeah. You're against, the Black Moses.
Yeah.
And so the thing is that they obviously could have developed the African American ethnicity into another basically, first level civilization ethnic component. It was well on its way. I actually think that they went integration. Well, they had to in some sense first, but they went there with some urgency because they could see that the African American was actually developing into a strong ethnicity. In other words, that all of like the out of wedlock birth rates were going down.
Mm-hmm.
Education level was going up. Can't have that. So instead they rushed Kenyon into position and then also put drugs into the inner cities and of course the thing that really hammered him was the welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
Marriage was no longer basically something that a woman needed to enter into. In fact, was discouraged by the laws, and so all of these demographic trends that had been on the uptick since Civil War, they all reversed, and that was the culture they wanted to integrate with the baby boomer. Because they wanted that culture, the African American culture, to be as debased as possible, so that they could then, particularly with the music, start to bring in deracinated, white middle class individuals and basically merge with the culture that was coming from the inner city now, which was more and more violence, drug based, out of wedlock births. The rap culture, started to become something that was starting to get into, white ethnicity. And then, of course, then all of the trends inside the white ethnicities also started to collapse.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. And so you can see that if it wasn't an operation, why didn't they reverse the social engineering aspects that were creating, the destruction? And in fact, they just kept pedal to the metal with all of them. And so, the public really needs to know that they have been attacked. And if they want to find a path to a better future, they have to recreate or go reverse what has been done to them. They need to look to community. They probably need to look to their, family and ethnicity. And they certainly have to look into, children being produced inside of marriage and things like this. This is what they got to do.
And there is, I think there are some real political consequences to some of the demographics that have been going on since the 1960s. And this was the politics of birth control, the weakening or the declining of the Caucasian, white, or European majority in the United States, because it is a European society. It's a transplant of European society, and its institutions reflect European culture. And as the dominant European culture in the United States declines, it's a good bet that whatever moorings it had to constitutional government are going to decline further. And this is there's a problem. Demographics is politics, and that's why there's demographic warfare. And Now you can say, will a country that's only 35% white still have anything resembles a constitution, there's a good chance that it won't, because it's the culture is going to be different. The political culture is going to be fundamentally different. And liberals acknowledge this. I was reading, there was an article by Adam Winkler called "The NRA Will Fail, It's Inevitable." And he's looking at demographics. He says support for an opposition to gun control closely associated with several demographic characteristics, including race, level of education, whether one lives in a city. Nearly all are trending forcefully against the NRA, meaning that as America becomes less, quote, white, there'll be less support for the NRA. So what they're saying is that ethnic groups have a certain politics, and we should judge those politics on their merit. And what he's saying is that there is demographic warfare, and there is a reason why they're trying to weaken or dilute or do away with the majority European American civilization to achieve these political objectives. So sure. if you could acknowledge that you can undermine the political support for something like the Second Amendment by diluting the white population, well, they're acknowledging demographic warfare. They're acknowledging the argument that America has an interest in maintaining its demographics. That's why you've had demographic warfare. That's why you had this flood of immigration from the South in the United States. It's had a horrible, very negative consequences in the Southwest and all throughout the parts of the United States. You're seeing a similar thing in Europe going on. You know, the immigration from or migration from these civil wars that are, ironically created by NATO. these NATO countries, or NATO's, stirring up trouble in Libya and Syria and these things, all for the purposes of demographic, or at least largely for the purposes of demographic warfare, to do away with things like German ethnicity, maybe ultimately create sort of a diluted pan-Europeanism, which is almost like the Kalergi plan of the early 20th century, was dilute the or do away with ethnicity in Europe and create a pan-Europeanism based on what he called a weakened mongrel race. There's no ethnic identity, because without ethnic identity, you become atomized and you're weaker, you're easier to rule over or control. And so, I mean, what I'm saying is, even when they talk about when liberals or multiculturalists savor the decline of white America, and part of that is saying, "Whoa, but it's going to be a much different country politically." Well, you're acknowledging the anxiety that many feel about that demographic decline of white America. Then, you should debate that on the merit. You can't. Well, I know why they do it. They don't want to debate it on those terms because they're admitting their malevolence. But if you're acknowledging that a fundamental shift in the country's demographics, the decline in the Caucasian or European or white population, is going to have a fundamental shift in its politics, then there's a sound argument for reversing or maintaining the demographics. And that way you have to restrain immigration, promote higher birth rates in these things. And that's one of the reasons why they promoted birth control, because you want a rapid decline in birth rates in some of these ethnic groups. And that's one of the reasons why they destroyed the ethnic neighborhoods, because a lot of these ethnic neighborhoods were Catholic, Irish Catholic, Polish right. Catholic, German Catholic, high birth rates. They didn't practice
birth control.
You have big families and communities, and no, it won't be a good reliable subject of the empire. So that's another problem. Another problem, again, it's not acknowledged with the civil rights movement, was, getting voting rights is important. Being granted your privileges and immunities of other American citizens is important, but there was always there's a tendency in the black community not to address the problems of sexual immorality or sexual dysfunction and the horrors it unleashes. It creates a cycle of despair because you have family breakup. You never even have family cohesion to begin with. And of course, this despair manifests itself in just continuing the cycle of out-of-wedlock births, higher sexual abuse, crime, joining gangs, really high crime rates. If you look at these statistics, and this is, why – they still like to blame whitey for all the problems, when really, if you have a birth, if you have an illegitimacy rate of 75-80%, you're never going to solve your poverty problem. But the interesting statistics involving crime, and I have here it is. This is an article by a man who goes by the name of Paul Kersey. That's his pen name. The Color of Gun Crime in America's Big Cities. And this is a serious problem. Because if you look at this at the numbers, this is the first city. New York City Despite being only 20, here we go, in New York City, it's, I guess this is based on the 2016 Crime Enforcement Activity in New York City report. And it says the city is 32.1% white, 29.1% Hispanic, and 22% black. Now, despite being only 22% of the city's population, the report found blacks comprised a majority, 52.4% of murder and non-negligent manslaughter arrests. Hispanics are exceeded their population share, accounting for 35.9% of arrests for these crimes. Despite being almost a third of the city's population, the white suspects accounted for less than 7% of the share. Another city here is New York City. This means that in 2016, 88.3% of those arrested for murder as non-negligent manslaughter and 96.7% of those arrested for shootings were black or Hispanic. So that's that in New York. In Philadelphia, the United States Census estimated in 2016 population Philadelphia to be 44% black, 34.9% white, and 14.4% Hispanic. According to a 2015 murder shooting analysis from Philadelphia Police Department, there were 280 murders in Philadelphia in 2015 with 236 committed with firearms. But how it breaks down here is, in 2015 there were the numbers, just quickly get to the numbers here. In 2016 there were 1,236 non-fatal shootings, but only 238 offenders were identified. Blacks were 85% of them, with whites were 13%. In Milwaukee is 40% black, 37% white, and 17.3% Hispanic. Let me get the numbers here. Scrolling down. Okay, suspects were identified in all. For the non-fatal shootings, 88% were black, 6% were white, and 5% were Hispanic. So, and of course, then this pretty much follows along the line. In Chicago, it's pretty much the same story. Los Angeles, it's interesting because, according to the 2016 community survey, Los Angeles is 49% Hispanic, 29% white, 8% black, 11% Asian. The numbers.
Well, I just think that it's clear. Almost every American knows that the statistics are asymmetrical.
Of these statistics,
African Americans are more likely to commit violent crime.
Yeah, same thing with New Orleans. So you have a serious problem of crime, and this radiates, I think, ultimately, largely from illegitimacy, the breakup of the Black family.
Of course, it was that they were the most vulnerable culture.
Yeah.
They were specifically targeted with the Great Society, notes the double talk programs, and also because they were easier basically to get into drug culture.
Yeah.
They fell faster and harder than anyone. All I can say is that obviously they were doing better in the 50s than they were in. Currently, mm-hmm. and they were on the uptick. Where parity is, or where the conclusion of all is, who knows? But I would have been astounded. In fact, I am certain that they would have entered into an ethnic structure that would have been very similar in the statistics, or at least close to the European ethnicities, if they had continued with the same social structure, because they were just moving in a good direction. When they hit them with the Great Society programs and out of wedlock births were starting to coupled with the drug culture. And remember, this was also when a lot of the employment opportunities in the inner city started to disappear. So they were just hit in every different direction. Yeah. And you end up with a gang culture. And then basically now in many areas, it's no culture. I mean, there are kids being brought up by individuals who aren't even their relatives. You know, there's no mother, no father, there's no one. So,
And now you have, I think, a similar thing with Hispanics and the MS-13, which is sort of a they're sort of a proxy force because the problems with the large inundation, you know, with the inundation of migrants from the south, you know, from Mexico and Central America, they know they're going to come in and join these gangs, and then that'll be an excuse for a greater, you know, more police state measures.
Yep. You know. So I just wanted to circle back, to use that current expression that's going around, to point out that, you know, these structures are, one can trace them back so often to that combination that I have talked about so many times of elite Jews and Masons, right? You can see that in Martin Luther King's case, you know, you have the Masonic background, but the NAACP, which spawned Rosa Parks and then was basically, you know, the kind of one of the organizing forces for Martin Luther King, even though it calls itself, you know, National Association for Advancement of Colored People, it was completely Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And what was really amazing to me, and just wanted to, is that in the first board members, you had Rabbi Stephen Wise and Jacob Schiff. and the reason why that's important is that Wise is basically a ultra-racist Zionist, right? I mean, he's just a rabid Zionist. No love for the dark-skinned Palestinians, right? But for some reason, he wants to be in the NAACP. And then when I found that Jacob Schiff was on the board, and actually he's the one who actually gave him all the money originally, of course, my eyebrows flew up because, you know, the Schiff family is basically what you're talking about is the Rothschild, the Jewish banking family that that with the Warburgs and the Loebs had been basically bound by marriage for, you know, 100 years. And one thing that is important to know is that the Schiff family actually lived with the Rothschild. Did you know that? They actually had the same house.
No, I didn't know that close.
Generation. Yeah, the Schiffs and the Rothschild had lived in the same home. And so you can see that it's not, you know, it's a very, very close relationship. It's very, very inbred. The families marry back and forth. And so now this is very peculiar, isn't it? Because the Rothschilds are extremely well documented as having made a tremendous amount of money out of the slave trade. Right.
Mm-hmm.
They just, you know, won like bandits with the slave trade. This was all documented and the banking families in general. But now here, lo and behold, the Schiff family is deciding now we're trying to promote the interests of the Africans in America.
Yeah, this is the Black Jewish Alliance that prevailed until the 1960s.
You scratch your head, you go, well, wait a second. What happened to making all the money on the slave trade? You know, how come you were doing that if you were so, you know, bound and determined to help the black people? This doesn't make any sense. And so this is, again, this is just kind of the, you know, the normal, you know, structure of you see when you look at these culturally destructive structures and you can see, well, how is it being set up? You find so often this combination of, you know, a Masonic component and then these elite Jewish families. And then of course the question that falls out is how do they function? And I keep saying over and over again, man, I just want to get, you know, the Harrimans, the Golds and the Rockefellers, you know, DNA tested. One thing that is a slight tangent, but I really want to bring out is that. So there was there's a family involved in all of this and the production of King that's a woman and her last name is Foster, and you know like Alan Foster Dulles, right? Mm-hmm. And so her family is related into that, the family of Dulleses. And I was looking at this family and I noticed just an amazing fact. I'd never come across this. And I was wondering if you were aware of it, that the family that produced Alan Dulles also produced another individual who they've been Presbyterians, but this one individual decided he would convert to Catholicism. And do you know what he ended up as becoming? He became a cardinal.
Oh, you're talking about the Dulles.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so the reason why I bring this up is because people wonder, like, well, what happened to the Catholic Church? You know, like E. Michael Jones talks about Notre Dame being basically converted into a secular, you know, gay disco. You know, how did this happen? Well, the idea that you would get, you know, Dulles's cousin who to convert to Catholicism and then go up the ranks so quickly to end up as a cardinal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how could that be if there wasn't, you know, control inside the organization of creation of the cardinals? It's impossible. Yeah. Right. So now you can see what happened to the Catholic Church is that it had its power structure was taken over. And this is the pattern that I would just want everyone to be aware of, is that when you see the Dulles, you know, converting to Catholicism,
this is Avery Dulles, I think.
Avery Dulles, yeah. And then a meteoric rise, right? I mean, think about this, Tim. You know, there he is. He converts to Catholicism, and like a decade later, becomes a cardinal.
Yeah, he was at Harvard?
Yeah,
along Boston, he saw a tree and realized there was God or something. That's what he said.
Yeah, it's like circumstantially completely ridiculous. But the fact is that here is the secret society with a weak storyline that's very, you know, demonstrably, you know, disprovable.
No, Miles Mathis gets a little bit into like the Billy Graham story, which is
and that, of course, again, it's, you know, you can just see that their control. But you see, my point is that when you look at the Dulles as a cardinal, you can see, oh my God, the political structure of the Catholic Church has been taken over. The secret society has taken over. And this, of course, would explain why they chose to, like, give the financial control over the church over to the Rothschild family.
And also you had the push towards ecumenism in the 60s.
Exactly. And all of the ways that the Catholic Church has been basically neutered. I mean, but here is just, in my opinion, just something that a normal person can understand, as this is just impossible to be anything other than political control. And this is what happens everywhere. You see, a tiny minority can control us, can destroy us, if they take control of our political system. And this is what's happened. This is what's happened, Tim. And when you see the Dulles conversion to Catholicism one day, and being one of the people who can vote in the making of a pope the next, you know, I mean, you're looking right at a controlled political system, and it is a microcosm of what is producing Martin Luther King, is producing the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, is producing the popularity of rhythm and blues.
Mm-hmm. You
know, all of these things are being basically pushed into existence by the organization.
And then Elvis Presley's produced as sort of a white Chuck Berry.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And of course, the white Negro, of course, that's,
Norman Mailer.
Norman Mailer, and there's the Jack Kerouac's idea of spade kicks, the sort of this romanticizing or idea that whites would envy the sexual freedom of the blacks, promoting it,
exactly.
The culture.
Yeah,
and
these, exactly.
You know,
completely culturally destructive and completely incoherent, but makes perfect sense in terms of the operation to push culture into this cesspool.
Mm-hmm. Have you given any? One thing you do allude to this Black Jewish Alliance, and this is the same time, roughly around 1913, that the ADL B'nai B'rith is created, largely as a reaction to the Leo Frank trial in Atlanta, Georgia. Leo Frank was the head of B'nai B'rith in Atlanta, Georgia, who was convicted of raping and killing a young girl, Mary Fagan, and he subsequently tried to frame two black men for the crime. He was convicted, and then powerful Jews from New York, from around the country. I think the New York Times was brought on board to fight fight for Leo Frank's retrial, and they got the judge to give him clemency. And the locals down there were so upset because they'd given him a trial. There were three Jews even on the jury that convicted him unanimously. He was subsequently lynched, dragged out of prison, and lynched. Justice was done in their eyes, and as a result, they created ADL, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, and this was the beginning of the war in the South. The Jewish war in the South. Prior to that, the South actually had been nominally pro-Jewish. It's actually they're very Old Testament, you know, minded people, and anti-Semitism wasn't something that was associated with the South. And that came out of this Leo Frank trial when they started to target the South. The South was an easy target. It was an occupied province. It was poor, perceived as being backward. And that's when the Black Jewish Alliance was a strategy to exploit Black grievances in the country, to revolutionize them, to turn them into revolutionaries, avant-garde, to become social revolutionaries, to upend governments and change the culture. And using the issues of integration or racial segregation in the South and these things on their face, legitimate issues, but again, these are fissures that are being exploited, aren't fissures that are being healed. And then for the better part of 30, 40 years, the Jews targeted the South, and then in the 60s, they went north into the cities, and there was a character, a best illustration of that is King's failed mission into Chicago when he went into under housing integration, i.e. destroy ethnic neighbors in Chicago, when he tried to apply the same methods in Chicago that did in the South. The North was very different. It wasn't racial. It was ethnic. These were ethnic neighborhoods. Had no legal segregation, just ethnic. And he was pretty much told that by the local ministers there and by Mayor Daley, and sent packing. But it's interesting enough that he was sent north, I believe, given $20,000 by Nelson Rockefeller to do this. And it was done to break up these neighborhoods. Yeah, I mean, he went into some neighborhood that was like Lithuanian. And then the march was pretty much saying, get out of here. You know, you should integrate. But the problem is, these are ethnic neighbors. You can't integrate an ethnic neighbor without destroying the ethnic neighborhood. So pretty much what they were saying was, we want you to leave. We want to destroy your community. And this was a larger project that had gone back 20 years, 20, 30 years, an attempt by the American government, by the foundations, and by Jewish organizations. Also the Quakers, the American Friends Society, were part of this. The SWAS Jewish Alliance, to destroy the ethnic neighborhoods because of their concern over Catholic, or what they call differential fertility, the high birth rates of the Catholics, which led to the election of John F. Kennedy in 1960. But they were very concerned about Catholic power in America. Catholics were seen as not being legitimate Americans. And properly speaking, maybe they shouldn't be, given America's Masonic founding roots.
Yeah,
you know, Catholics should
be an American, that isn't a Mason.
In fact, what you mentioned, the infiltration of the Catholic Church, one of the weaknesses there was American Catholicism prospered, and they thought they owed the country a lot, and they wanted to be Americans. The problem is, given the power structure in America, its Masonic power structure, Catholics should never have a place at the table. They should be outside. They shouldn't be.
Well, all of the American cardinals, I think,
yes,
after a certain point, were Masons or are part of the secret society, and they just basically worked to create a majority. And once they did, then they owned the church. They mm-hmm. simply took possession of it. And I mean, this was hundreds of years ago.
Certainly. Yeah. So King went in there in 1966, tried to do it, and it was a failed mission. Daley, who was a Catholic, his constituents were Catholic, and these things, they weren't going to hear it because they were ethnic. I mean, it just wasn't. He had no business going north because he had no idea. He had no, even if you take seriously the King's narrative, he was from the South. He knew the South. Okay, that's where he belonged. It was ridiculous to come up to the North. They're creating this national character, this sort of this icon. You know, which is pretty much just a totem, right? I mean, these icons, they're there to be put up and taken down. So he had no familiarity with the problems in the North, and he had no business going up there. But then he was used as a tool to achieve the breakup of those neighborhoods so they could change the demographics of those areas and ultimately change the politics. A good example of the importance of ethnicity in politics is this character Mullen in Philadelphia. He was a Catholic Democrat. He was just a local, he was a state senator. But he came from such a solid Irish Catholic district. He was very powerful. He controlled the budget, and he could stop the budget. And in the 1960s, when they were trying to, this is after the Supreme Court dutifully declared contraception to be a right, although it wasn't a law that was being enforced. But the importance of that decision, the Griswold v. Connecticut decision, was to create a pathway where government could start promoting contraception as opposed to just letting people have it. I mean, the freedom to buy if they want it. Because once it was declared a right, then the government could get in the business of promoting. They immediately went in the business trying to promote it, working with Planned Parenthood and this stuff. Well, Mullen, this very ethnic, conscientious Catholic, controlled the purse strings, and he refused to get it out of committee. This one man who was representing this very Catholic district in Philadelphia was stopping the state of Philadelphia from promoting birth control. And it wasn't until they used integration to bust up his neighborhood that he was redistricted and lost his seat. You know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And that's an example of ethnic identity stopping one of the more ambitious political social engineering, one of the more aggressive social engineering schemes of, of the New World Order in the 1960s and 70s was that, and again, without the ethnic identity, he wouldn't have the political base to do that. He wouldn't even have the consciousness to even oppose it.
Well, the thing is that, I mean, King was a cutout. I mean, there was nothing in that he didn't represent any, as far as I can tell, any legitimate or self-generated ideas. His speeches were written by a guy named Stanley Levinson.
Yeah.
Less, and Levinson was a Zionist kind of Jewish controller who worked with individuals on the NAACP. And, it's funny. I mean, the NAACP didn't even have a black president for the first 50 years of its existence. It was always run by Jewish oligarch appointees. You can cut it any way you want, but that's just the absolute truth. You look through the board members and where the money's coming from. It is just it's another indication of these elite Jewish families behind the scenes creating a social structure that is for the destruction of the Europeans, right? And then of course there is this Masonic influence with it. And this is just this is our history, Tim. This is the real history. You have the religious structure of Martin Luther King showing up in Chicago with the idea of like, well, I'm here to promote integration. Look, King doesn't have a clue about integration. This guy has no idea about the good or bad. He is just doing what he's told to do.
Mm-hmm.
He is a cutout. Basically what we're dealing with is the result and the effects of a religion. And it's the problem is it's been so well conditioned into Americans as a religion that it's almost like trying to convert someone from a particular belief in God. If you go through it and you say, well, look, King is supported by the NAACP and the Southern Christian something. I mean, and these organizations are completely structured through Masons and elite Jewish families with their appointees and their money, and they are part of an overall structure to destroy white general ethnicity. Their mind just short circuits. They can't, they go, literally it's like telling someone that their religion is false.
Yeah.
They just don't have any, nothing works in their mind when they, and so then you have the problem of, well, how do you get the information to them? And I think, one good way is to just look at Martin Luther King and basically go through all of the structures of his life, his speeches, his behavior, his PhD, his name, his death. And then you can start to see after a while that it's all fake. There's just nothing here. There's not a real person here.
And how about the the theatrical or ritual element to their to these assassinations, whether it's Martin Luther King or Robert F. Kennedy or John F. Kennedy, is there's many ways that the deep state has at their disposal to get rid of an inconvenient person. Why would they choose such bloody ways to do it? Is it because of they want the imagery? They want the carnage to have the effect on society, the sort of bloodening of society, the same way the Vietnam War would have on society, because it adds to sort of the chaos, chaotic atmosphere of the times?
Well, trauma-based mind control. I mean,
yeah.
The Beatles were introduced 77 days after JFK was publicly assassinated. Mm-hmm. You know, the nation was, you know, knocked off stride psychologically. And so here comes the Beatles. And gee whiz, it's just wonderful. You know, the music upbeat. And this is the gentle introduction to the sex, drugs, and rock and roll culture. Mm-hmm. In King's case, I think, you know, they wanted it because they wanted to basically create the guilt sacrament. You know, so you have the white supremacists kill them, you know, and then, of course, the riots and things. And you know, King will forever, as he's represented, it'll be in his speech, you know, I may not make it to the, you know, to the promised land. You know, that is going to basically be the religious structure that America will always be conditioned by, right, henceforth.
This also creates the whole idea of the street protest, right? With the marches and these things.
Yeah.
This is a model for activism. The feminists picked this up. Gay rights activists picked this up. The sort of going into the store protest and refusing to leave and these things.
What's going on today with the gun protest by the students?
Yeah. And you had this ridiculous situation last week in the Starbucks in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
You know, where two loitering black men are asked to leave. They didn't. The manager calls the police, and then they refuse to leave, so they get arrested, and this becomes an opportunity for a massive protest. And the whole, you know, the whole Mockingbird media is you know, it's obviously it's fake. It's street theater like much of the civil rights movement was. But this feigned outrage. And then Starbucks, this corporation, they apologize. They cashier the manager, get rid of her, apparently. But the bottom line is, any look at it and goes, well, if they weren't buying anything and they were asked to leave, they should leave, regardless of whether or not the store does this to other people. You know, who knows what's going on, what their demeanor was or anything. You don't know. But nevertheless, it's picked up, you know, by the media, and this becomes an opportunity for another Rosa Parks moment, right? Everyone's Rosa Parks, right?
I mean, I've noticed that, they're kind of ratcheting up the process whereby the white male is destroyed, is marginalized, is, you know, made to seem as a racism, as a problem, you know. And these are things that, you know, need to be overcome, you know, by political activism, you know. And it just, oh man, you know, it's like these aren't the real problems, but people are, they're very easy to get them focused on that. Yeah. And then once they do, then they basically, you don't have to worry about them ever having the right problem that they're trying to work on.
Yeah, and once this meme gets out there, or this way of protesting gets out there in the consciousness, plenty of individuals are going to act upon it. Like, you had that a couple of years ago, you had a student who was talking on her cell phone in class, interrupting the class, and reportedly the teacher told her to get rid of it, and she refused because it was her constitutional right to talk on the phone during class, apparently. And so then the security guard was called in. Of course, why do you need armed security guards in public schools is another question. But then he manhandles her, drags her out of class, and this becomes an issue. Now, why didn't she just politely, you know, turn her phone off and stop interrupting people? Because she has a right. No, and problems. And if you're an oppressed minority, and you're, you know, especially recognized oppressed minority, and because you are oppressed, you no longer have the burden of having to be polite, you know, or follow, you know, any tours of public decorum or anything, because you know you're oppressed, and that it makes, you know, it makes more or less the public sphere inhabitable. You can't, you know, discuss anything, and that's exactly what they want. They want chaos, and demonstrations, rioting, and occasional riots. Good, and those can be easily fomented and filmed, and that can scare everybody, and that justifies coming, bringing in the tanks that the DHS, you know, gives to some local police force. You know, it's just all nonsense, you know, but it's usually based on very little or something. You know, of course, then you have the occasional, you know, you also have the police brutality stories, you know, and then that, like, I think you and I both talked about how it's sort of a dialectic. You have the militarization, some people call it the Israelization of the police, because police are being trained by Israeli specialists and tactics, and basically now they're treating many people like Palestinians, are being trained to treat that. They're also given military hardware and uniforms, and their deportment's going to change, how they approach the public. They, police now commonly refer to the public as civilians. Well, police are civilians. Police are not military. But you hear policemen referred to, largely because a lot of policemen are former military. Now they have hiring preferences now. So you have that dynamic. At the same time, you also have we talked earlier about these really high crime rates among certain communities like Hispanic, particularly the Black community, particularly among young Black men. And so there's a dialectic there, you know, there are two problems, and they're not mutually exclusive, nor is, you know, one isn't, you know, isn't a question of supporting the cops, and nor is it a question of hating the cops. It isn't a question of ignoring the problems in the Black community, acknowledging that there is police brutality and their civil rights are being violated. But again, it's also a function of the breakdown, destruction, or the, you know, complete erasing the Black family and all the social pathologies that come from that. And that's high crime. And I think you and I both talked about in the past how this is all part of a plan. So,
yeah, I mean, we're going to beg for the police state.
Yeah.
So they can, that's what I think what this is all about. They're going to get violence, you know, terrorism. If the public won't do it, then the terrorists will be brought in to do it, where then they can say, well, the public is demanding a police state. Mm-hmm. We don't want to do it, but we're just going to have to do it. It'll only be for a short period of time. It's going to be national martial law, but don't worry, we'll get this, you know, worked out, and then we'll have our freedom to return. But that'll be, you know, never.
Look at the cities. I mean, since the 1960s and all these Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, you've had cities like, like Selma, Alabama. What's the condition of that city now since they were liberated, since the end of segregation?
Well, I mean, it's like what you can see this all immediately, because once when after Brown v. Board of Education, the white middle class left the cities. And what did that do to the school system? You know, the school system went into the tank for a number of reasons. But one was is because the tax dollars that had been supporting it left. And so schools that had been integrated, in other words, that had a small fraction of African-Americans in them, but would nevertheless, that was an important component of the Black community, because a lot of those kids were there, you know, were coming from their burgeoning middle class, and then they could end up going back and then keeping the cycle, the righteous cycle, going inside the African-American community. Well, suddenly all of the whites left, because, you know, once you got over like 40% or some number that has been, you know, determined, the whites didn't feel like it was their school anymore, and they took off. And then now the idea of integration being in back of these social programs, of course, is obviously absurd, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's created segregation. It's created far worse segregation imaginable. They, you know, they weren't trying, and they never have been, to solve the problems of the African American community.
No.
They are trying to use it as a tool in their attempt to destroy Europeans. And that's really how it's been used. That's what King was. That's what the integration of the music was. And that's really the tragedy of why they debased the African-American community, why they put the drugs into it, why they, you know, developed rap music, for heaven's sakes, you know. These things were done because they thought that this would be the first of all, so that they didn't have to worry about the African-American community becoming something that could resist the kind of social control that they're after. But moreover, so that it would just constantly be moving down and dragging the whites that would be more and more integrated with it down the same path. If you look at the statistics, you talk about the violence. You know, I'm afraid to say it, but I wouldn't be surprised if in 20 years that a lot of the white communities that are integrated communities are going to be going to the same level of violence that the African Americans are. We certainly are following their illegitimate birth statistic down into the abyss. And I wouldn't be surprised if the other things started to go in that direction too, because, you know, remember, the manufacturing jobs were also used by a lot of whites, and these jobs are gone.
Mm-hmm.
How does, you know, if you look at the statistic that for the first time, I think since they've been collecting the data, that European lifespan is shrinking, you know, I mean, this tells you that that culture is in real trouble. And so, you know, it's it is, as long as we don't understand that the what we see as reality and all of these problems and the direction we're headed in are being created by a malevolent and organized force, we are helpless. We participate in a political system that is a matrix. It's a joke. We aren't looking at the real problem.
What if in the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, instead of Sidney Poitier, they cast someone like Snoop Doggy Dogg? You think would have the same reaction?
Yeah, well,
you know, I mean, you know,
but you can see how this is how they did it, and that's why, you know, it's always the incrementalism, you know, so that they could slowly bend culture into. But now they have just this full throttle of trying to promote racial marriage, interracial marriage. I mean, it's just everywhere.
Well, it is. I mean, it's almost like, I, you know, most people are, when it comes to that, are either, they're laissez-faire. They're not in the business of telling people who they shouldn't marry in these things. But it gets to the point where you're just being hit over the head with it constantly, and imagery, television, you know, commercials and TV shows, and same thing with homosexuals and TV shows and these things. It's like,
and the response is to say, why are they doing this?
Yeah, why are they doing
what
this?
What is the point? You see, if the public just sits and is conditioned, if only the public in general would just say why, because then they could start to do the research.
It's like that. Most people don't care what's going on in the privacy of someone's bedroom. But last time I checked, you know, when they have the gay parade going out in front of an elementary school, that's not in your bedroom anymore, right? Or two gay men are arrested in a park somewhere, and this, you're violating my privacy. You're in a park, for free Pete's sake, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's no privacy here anyway. So, yeah, that's the difference. Most people aren't willing to go on a puritanical crusade to try to weed out the perverts in the community. That they take a live and let live attitude. And if people follow some idea of privacy and respect boundaries, but they're not doing that. We're in a situation now where transvestites are reading storybooks to elementary school kids in the library.
This was all brought to us in the context of the religion of integration.
Yes, tolerance.
Integration was created into a religion. And so then when you could sweep into the religion gays, right, well, then next comes the transgender community, right?
Well, the avant-garde, I mean, said at one point the avant-garde was the radicalized revolutionary black, promoted by the Jewish power structure. And then it became feminist, and now it's homosexuals.
Right. You know? And so the way to try to understand that is to, is to deconstruct it in terms of, well, who's manipulating this and where is it coming from? But instead, people are intimidated because the power of the religion of integration.
Yet if you had ethno-religious consciousness, you'd tell them to go fly a kite,
exactly.
You know?
And you see, that was the structure that produced the beneficial world of the 1950s and 60s, with all of the families and wealth creation and all of these benefits. And now we look at, you know, the single mom and the pornographic male, and we go, gee, you know, we have this great religion of integration, but it doesn't seem to be working culturally. Well, maybe it will in the future, you know, once we get rid of, bigotry against transgender people, you know, or some, you know, whatever the latest meme is. But, you know, it is, if the public in general doesn't take that step to try to think about what is the motivation behind the people that are bringing these images and these cultural transformative issues into existence, they're just helpless. They are literally like, you know, a creature in the movie The Matrix that doesn't know the Matrix exists. They are just without the capacity to respond.
Yeah, it's like the in the 1970s, the Southies in Boston, whose kids were being bused 2-3 hours a day to fit some sort of federal judge's fetish of integration in the schools. And they started protesting the busing, and the media portrayed these people from Boston who weren't the most media savvy people, just working class folk, as being these backward racists. You know, all of a sudden they were being treated like Southerners. and again, they lacked the grammar or sophistication to understand what was being done to them. But the idea was they were more or less being destroyed. They wanted to be chased out and lose, yep. I guess up there it's Irish Catholic, and lose that identity.
And so the thing is that they have to have the strength to fight back. They have to lose the intimidation is that they're dealing with the religion. Mm-hmm. And I think that tonight, I hope we've had some value toward that, because I do think that it isn't too hard to piece apart Martin Luther King, the religious figure, and realize that there is no human being there, that this is just stagecraft, that this was a deliberately created fictional character for the purpose of creating religion so that people would be intimidated and they wouldn't use their normal common sense to try to understand what the government was doing, what the secret society was manipulating them toward. They would be intimidated because of this power of religion, which, you know, you have integration as the cult and the high sacrament is guilt, right?
Yes.
Martin was killed by the white supremacist. You don't want to be like him. So this is, it's crude, but man, it's been effective. So hopefully, if enough people become aware of this and start to really pick into King as a fake, you know, as basically as a character in a TV movie, then, this will be a great force, because then people start to lose the intimidation. You know, and they can speak and think clearly.
Yeah, your analytical approach changes, and you become more critical in these things. And most importantly, you're not intimidated anymore by it.
That's the goal, brother.
You know, so, well, Joe, thanks a lot.
Hey, it's been my pleasure, Tim. We'll get them next week, okay?
Okay, enjoy the rest of your weekend.
You too. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.